are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, October 15th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, we're going to talk polling, models, predictions, the night of the first debate, not so much for the primaries, but for the general election, with Rachel Bitticoffer, Assistant Director of the Watson Center for Public Policy. Also on the program today, it is debate night with Iowa 4 months away. This is the most consequential of debates, I think, that we've had. Meanwhile, turns out John Bolton objected quite strenuously to the Ukraine pressure. Will he be the one who gets Trump impeached? Meanwhile, Fed's investigating Rudy Giuliani's business dealings, which apparently involve some stuff in Ukraine, oddly enough.
Appropriate stuff.
Facebook pays a pittance in a private settlement for destroying a wide swath of journalism in this country. Russians in between Syrian and Turkish forces as Syria makes a deal to fight with the Kurds. Meanwhile, Bernie releases a massive corporate accountability plan. Mike Bloomberg, remember him? Supposedly having second thoughts about running for president. Meanwhile, the Trump supporter violent video is even more disturbing than you thought. New report, child leukemia drug shortage. A great argument to nationalize some drug production. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. A lot of stuff going on today. Obviously, the debate is happening tonight. Going to be a very consequential debate for a number of reasons. One, Bernie Sanders has to come out and show people, and I think there's some, it's reflected in some polls and other polls not, people concerned about voting for someone who just had a heart attack. But tonight, I think, and for the rest of the week, as Sanders begins to go more and more public, I think this will be very consequential in showing people exactly what kind of physical shape he's in. Also, I think we're going to see Pete Buttigieg smells a little blood in the water with Joe Biden, is going to go strong. It's going to be interesting to see what Warren does at this point as well. I have a feeling Warren and Bernie are just going to keep letting Joe Biden sink. There is a poll that is out today. I don't know how well esteemed this this poll is, so I'm not going to be too congratulatory, self-congratulatory. But I will just put a marker in there because, you know, sometimes you wake up in the morning, your son tells you over and over again because you won't let him watch TV that he hates you. Something like this helps when you get into the office. In the most recent George Washington University poll, Senator from Massachusetts, that would be Elizabeth Warren, leads the Democratic field. This is a national thing. 28% of the vote. Sanders second at 21%. Biden at 18%. If you'll recall, I don't know when this was. back early summer, late spring, I suggested that by October-ish, Joe Biden would be third in the polls. This is the first time that's happened. Now, it could be an outlier, but I will take it and run with it because that's what I need, ladies and gentlemen. So forgive me. Sorry. Sorry if you have a problem with that. A lot of stuff happening on the impeachment front. These were the 2 weeks that we anticipated would take the momentum out of the impeachment push. Remember about, I guess it was it 2 weeks now? Has it been 2 weeks? That after Nancy Pelosi had announced that they were going forward with an impeachment inquiry, she said, and now we're going to take vacation for 2 weeks. But the committees have been working. They have been taking testimony. All the stories you're hearing about Bolton came out of testimony that happened on Friday with Fiona Hill. Well, yesterday with Fiona Hill, who is the who was an advisor to Donald Trump on Russia. And basically what she testified to, as far as we know, it was behind closed doors. It's been released by the committee, some of it. John Bolton was basically telling her that he's got nothing to do with the rogue thing that Rudy Giuliani, Sunderland, who was the EU ambassador, who apparently had just said, I'm in charge of Ukraine now. What? And Mick Mulvaney. At one point, John Bolton said, I'm not involved in this Giuliani-Mulvaney drug deal that they got going down in Ukraine. And I think the implication was not that they have a drug deal, but that they're up to something. And there's going to be more testimony. I will give you a breakdown later in the show, but well, I'll give it to you right now. Today was the date that Giuliani and Pence were supposed to deliver documents under a subpoena. It has already passed for Mike Pompeo. Those will be articles of impeachment, I imagine, as just prima facie obstruction. Fiona Hill showed up yesterday. Today, George Kent, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Europe and Eurasia, is scheduled to appear for a closed-door deposition. He was a career diplomat at the State Department who served in Ukraine from 2015 to 2018. Tomorrow, is it Matt McKinley? The guy who just resigned from the State Department, also a career diplomat. These are people who have no allegiance to Mike Pompeo. Michael McKinley. And then on Thursday, Gordon Sondland, the former European Union ambassador who just took control of Ukraine for whatever reason, will appear for a closed-door deposition. Trump didn't want him to testify. Now he is. And apparently he's going to say, you remember, Sondland's the one at the end of the transcript from the group text that I read, I guess it was about a week ago. He was the one who, after Bill Taylor, the former ambassador to Ukraine, said, as we said on the phone last night, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign. That is Taylor basically saying, hey, I just want to reiterate what I said last night so that when this is subpoenaed, I'm okay. And then Sondland said, oh, you're wearing a wire. Or that's the subtext. He actually said, no, there's no quid pro quo. In fact, Donald Trump told me there was no quid pro quo here. So there's no quid pro quo, as I've said. Anything else you want to talk about, we should talk maybe in person. In a park bench or something. Well, Sondland apparently is going to go with that line, that he had concerns, but then Trump assured him there was no quid pro quo. And so this is just happening all this week. And a lot of people are wondering why they're just doing private sessions. A big reason is you depose these people and then you bring them back for more testimony. And you can make sure that that testimony lands. So this is good stuff. Good stuff. We got a clip of Mike Pompeo. He had a run-in with a reporter from, what was it, Tennessee, I guess? Yeah, he got salamied. We'll get there in just a second. But a reminder, you spend one-third of your life in your sheets. Don't you want them to be insanely comfortable? Of course you do. And frankly, I'm also in for the durability because I like to keep my sheets for 10, 15 years.
I believe that.
It's true. When I find sheets I like to keep them. Brooklinen was named the best of online bedding by Good Housekeeping. It offers luxury sheets, towels, bedding, and more without the luxury markup. And they have over 20 plus colors and patterns. You can mix and match them. These sheets don't just feel great, they look great too. And like I say, they wear great. I have multiple sets of Brooklinen sheets. And basically, this is my whole new thing now. I used to buy like crappy stuff every other year, every year. And it tears and it rips and it's not good and it's not comfortable. And then you just sort of regret it. Now I buy nice stuff, but I don't have to spend the luxury markup because Brooklinen is not as expensive as you'd pay in the stores. I've got comforters. I've got, what do you call those covers? The duvet covers, sheet sets. I look like a grown-up now in my bed.
All grown-up.
Yep.
Fully paid-up member of the human race.
They're the most comfortable sheets I've ever slept on. Their towels are incredibly plush. I couldn't recommend them more for friends, family, treating yourself on the upgrade you deserve. And now Brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer just for my listeners. Get 10% off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. They're so confident in their product. All their sheets, their comforters, the towels come with a lifetime warranty. Only way to get 10% off and free shipping is to use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen, Brooklinen.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever. As you know, everybody in this office gearing up maybe for our language challenge. Are we still
bring
on
it.
That? Well, Babbel will be the motor behind that challenge. They can get you speaking a new language quickly and with confidence. You can choose from 14 different languages: Spanish, Portuguese, French, Italian, Russian. That's six. There's eight more. Babbel's teaching method and speech recognition technology has been proven effective across multiple studies, and the lessons are created by over 100 language experts. We're talking real human beings, not algorithms, not translation machines. Lessons are engaging. They're convenient. They last only about 10 to 15 minutes. You can use it across all of your platforms, your app, your phone, your iPad, your tablet, computer, doesn't matter. It's interactive in terms of the dialogues, so you can perfect your pronunciation and accent. We're going to go for it in this office. I want to learn Spanish. I know that's probably the easiest one of the languages to learn. Supposedly.
I would offer to help you, but it's a contest.
Exactly. Well, I don't need your help. We're going to go head to head on this. What does the winner get?
Learning is
Brendan?
About war, not about collaboration.
It's about, I'll tell you what you get. You get the ability to speak a second language, Brendan.
I'm not doing anything. I'm not on a line for anything. I'm not even buying anybody a cola.
Because you listen to this show, Babbel has a very special offer for you. You can go to Babbel.com, select the language of your choice. Once you try for free and you're ready to sign up, you select the three-month option. Babbel will slide you an extra 3 months for free. That's a two-for-one deal. Promo code MAJORITY. That's 6 months for the cost of three with promo code MAJORITY. Go to Babbel, Babbel.com. Enter promo code MAJORITY. Babbel, speak a new language with confidence. And lastly, how you spend your time, what you listen to, is totally within your control. But your personal information, that's a totally different story. When you shop, when you bank, when you browse online, when you answer your email sometimes, your personal information gets out there. You can lose control of it, exposing you to cybercrime. You've all heard the stories of people losing their identity. It is a complete nightmare. Thankfully, there's Norton 360 with LifeLock to help you get back of a sense of control and protect yourself and your personal information. It's an all-in-one membership for your cyber safety. It gives you device security, identity theft protection, and a VPN for online privacy and more. If there's any identity theft-related problem, they have agents who will work to fix it. Now, of course, no one can prevent all cybercrime and identity theft. But Norton's 360 with LifeLock is a powerful ally to help protect you in today's connected world. Look, I've been using the service now, I feel, for like a year. When I had to change apartments, I get a little notice. Somebody's doing a credit check on me. When I got like a credit card at the Kohl's, a 25% discount. I couldn't avoid it. Boom. I get a text alert telling me that somebody's signing up for a credit card. Well, it's me. I don't have to panic. I go in. I check my credit scores. I'm nervous about it. I'm nervous about having identity theft. And it is incredibly reassuring to go to LifeLock and see, like, okay, everything seems to be fine. And to know that in the event that worst case scenario happens, they have people who will help me resolve it. You can sign up today for a Norton 360 with LifeLock membership. And as our listeners, you're going to save 25% or more off your first year at Norton.com/majority. That's Norton.com/majority for 25% off. Check it out. Norton.com/majority. All right. Let's play this. Let's play this one clip. This is Mike Pompeo. He goes to Tennessee. Now, when you're the Secretary of State and you go into Tennessee and you're giving an interview for a local reporter, you're just like, oh, this is a freebie. This is just me getting out there, putting out the president's spin. Presidents can be, you know, president won't see it, but they'll be happy. Well, you know, my people send it in to the White House press thing and just know that, okay, we're talking to, you know, Tennessee's our peeps. And we're not getting into this impeachment stuff. This is going to be easy for me to go out there. And then, whoops, Pompeo meets up with, what's the name of this reporter? Do we know again? Nancy Amons. I feel like, relative to what we see with the national media, I feel like she deserves a Pulitzer for this.
In mid-February, you were in Warsaw. And so was Rudy Giuliani. During your time there, did you meet with Giuliani?
You know, I don't talk about who I meet with. I went to Warsaw for a particular purpose. It was an important mission. We brought together people all across the world to take down the world's largest state sponsor of terror, the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's what I worked on that mission.
So you're not going to say whether you met with him?
So when I was in Warsaw, I had a singular focus. My focus was singly on the work that we have done, effective work, to recover from what the Obama administration has done, which was to underwrite the world's largest state sponsor of terror. We've stopped that, and we're making real progress.
It sounds like you're not going to say.
When I was in Warsaw, we were working diligently to accomplish the mission to take down the terror regime that's inside the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's what I worked on. It was the only thing that I engaged in while I was there.
I asked him about text messages that showed diplomats under his authority told the Ukrainians that a good relationship with President Trump was only possible if they investigated his political opponent.
And were you aware that this was happening?
You know, again, you've got your facts wrong. Sounds like you're working, at least in part, for the Democratic National Committee.
Another question I asked the secretary about the resignation yesterday of one of his senior advisors, Michael McKinley. The secretary said it was a personnel matter and he wasn't going to discuss it. Nancy Amons, News 4.
She annihilated him.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow, that was great.
You
and
mad,
all
bro?
He's got is Iran thirst.
Yeah.
That's all he's got.
Nope. And I mean, he looked like he was, that first time he just looked at her, he looked like he had been just hit with a 2x4.
No, you're part of the Democratic National Committee. Shut up. These people really are so disgusting.
All right, we're going to take a, what's important about this clip? Is that if you're a local reporter in Tennessee, you're thinking, this is the story. Now, this is in Tennessee. And you're thinking, this is the story, impeachment. And I'm going to do a deep dive here. They put the entire 7 minutes online. But that clip was the one that they ran on TV. And when she's asking him about stuff directly involving impeachment with Giuliani and that exchange between Sondland and Bill Taylor, that means this is seeping through. Don't get too excited, because of course most of the places just have Fox News and
Sinclair Media.
But for her to do this in Tennessee, I think suggests that things are leaking on the good ship Trump. And we're going to talk to...
Can I just say really quick, this is the type of thing, if it's easy, you know, if you have a minute, dash her a little email or a note, because I have no doubt that the people who do take the, you know, Mike Pompeo's nonsense about her seriously, they are sending the station messages, and she should get feedback from people who appreciate her journalism.
And there's probably like a pro-Trump news director there too. So
I would do that. I'd send a nice thank you for the interview. You know, just thanks for the good work.
Yep. We're going to talk to Rachel Bitticofer, Assistant Director of Watson Center for Public Policy, in just a moment, about that 2020 race and some Senate races, House races, all that and more. To get you in the mood, back in the sort of like electoral mood with the debate coming up tonight, which incidentally, we will be doing live coverage of. So you can check us out tonight, 8 p.m., probably 7:45, we'll probably start the cameras.
What platform we on?
We're not sure yet. We're going to be either on Twitch or right on the Majority Report page. So we're still working on it. So you will check that out. Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Be right back.
Cold feet.
And that was Intellectual Dark Wave's rendition of Cold Feet, a song they have written about Steven Crowder.
The only good IDW, folks.
There you are, the Intellectual Dark Wave. Next up, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program someone who I think is the only female elections forecaster as far as I know, you know, sort of a professional in our politics today. She is the assistant director of the Wasson Center for Public Policy. Rachel Bitticofer, welcome to the program.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me.
All right. So now, Rachel, you are known and you came to my attention. I think it was I think I may have been following you on Twitter, but I'm not 100% sure. But I saw an interview, I think, in Salon, and we're with Paul Rosenberg, and you were the first to predict the blue wave in the 2018 election. And by predict, I mean not sitting in a bar. Well, maybe you were in a bar, but not sitting in a bar and just sort of like throwing it off. But you actually had a model that anticipated it.
That's correct. And, you know, not just he anticipated it in a term of various probabilities. I mean, really just specifically said Democrats are going to pick up about 40 seats. And I did it about 4 months before Election Day in 2018.
So, I mean, let's talk about this, you know, the paradigm that you're basing this off, that you were basing this off of. And, you know, and then I want to go back and look at some misconceptions that people have about 2016. And I want to talk about this model, how it impacts 2020. But what was it that you saw 4 months out that led you to be able to predict it down to almost the number of pickups?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you're framing it that way, because the model, the forecast, the seat share, to me, like, those things are byproducts, really. They're not the sexy part of what's going on. What's driving my research, and I think what the meat of the research is about, is it really it's a theory of electoral behavior updated for the polarized era that we live in, where a lot of our election commentary just has not moved on since the 1990s. Polarization has affected profoundly our institutions. I mean, look no further than the election of Donald Trump and the dysfunction. I mean, we're basically, you know, minutes away from institutional failure right now. So we know that our courts are polarized, our Congress is polarized. We see mass polarization in public opinion data emerging in the late 2000s. And yet our election consultants want to pretend that people are voting and behaving at the polls in the same old way. And what I was arguing, or what I argue with my elections theory, is really a gigantic paradigm shift. And so one of the reasons it took you a long time to find out about my research after the election I predicted was that it is pushing back on these long-held conventional wisdoms and status quo. And even after it performed well, a lot of people, especially, you know, the mainstream election Twitter people, have a really hard time letting go this idea that, you know, elections are going to hinge on candidate qualities and on fundraising and polling and all of these things. And I'm arguing, no. The only thing that matters is partisanship. Partisanship has always been important in elections,
Rachel,
but now,
well, I just
it's even more important.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't interrupt. But when you say they're using a paradigm from the 90s, let's just focus on what that paradigm was. I think on some level, people aren't even conscious of that as a paradigm, as opposed to just like the way things are. Like, I don't, like, you know, that there is no that there. I think it's become such commonplace wisdom, and, you know, because of course I talk to, 90% of the time I'm out and about, people just ask me about the election all the time, and this is a foregone conclusion that. About the electorate and about what candidates need to do. Let's start with what the assumptions were about the electorate in terms of like who was gettable or what, you know, who could vote for whom, that type of thing.
Yeah, no, that's probably a good idea. I should clarify exactly what this paradigm is arguing, and you know, so people can understand, you know, what I'm arguing, why it's so radical. And so what I'm saying is, all right, the assumptions that you're talking about are about how you win elections. You win elections because there's this chunk of people in the middle who are independents. They're pretty much the same people each election. The way that you appeal to them is by, you know, out-moderating the other side and serving up a more moderate or more attractive candidate, and these people will swing your way, right? Therefore, you know, the way you maximize your probability of winning is giving a candidate that is going to be unobtrusive and digestible, right? And that really the electorate is rational, they're reasonable, they can be persuaded that the argument's going to matter, and that, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, if your candidate is better, you're going to be able to go out there and win over this pool of, you know, reasonable, persuadable individuals. And that's so definitely the conventional wisdom.
Those people were people that I guess the conventional wisdom was sometimes they vote for Republicans, sometimes they vote for a Democrat. They vote for the one that they think, I mean, just they're just open minded. I mean, did we know these people supposedly as independents? I mean, how did we talk about these people?
We talk about them as independents, and there's a couple of key points here. Number one, we talk about them as a big group, more than 30% of the electorate, and that is wrong because most independents are what we call leaners. They lean to the Republicans or they lean to the Democrats, and leaners behave just like partisans. They vote like partisans. They have issue preferences like partisans. So the kind of person that you're describing where they might vote for a Republican in one cycle or vote for a Democrat in another, it's not that those people don't exist. About 10% of the overall electorate would fall into that pure independent category. But when you parse those people out in terms of how much of the vote share in, say, a state like Wisconsin they would make up, it'd be about 5%, and then you think about the fact that their vote would probably break no worse than 60-40. So that 5% divided into 60-40, you can see that it's not insignificant, but it's not as cataclysmic or as important as it might be made out. And here's the other thing that never gets discussed. The swing of independence, in my research, I show, is a product of turnout surge and decline of different independents showing up and leaving the electorate. So it's not just this same fixed pool of people who change their mind. A lot of the reason that independents look like they go with the Democrats one time and the Republicans the other time is because different independents are showing up in different cycles.
Okay, so now and that last part is different from – so let's distinguish just this idea of independents – from swing voters, right? Because you're saying that there are, nationally speaking, 10% of the voters are swing voters. But in the key states where it really makes a difference, where there's going to be contested, it's 5%, more like 5%. And that generally the swing voters still end up breaking almost, at best 60-40. To one side or another. So the marginal difference, the return on investment in going after these people is limited by, 5% of the electorate and then only, 20% of them, a 20% difference amongst that 5%. So the return on investment is small.
Yeah.
And that's different.
Yes, exactly. And I want to add one more thing to your mathematical equation there. The other thing I argue too is that swing, that 60 versus the 40,
yeah,
is also highly predictable because it's going to be 60 against whatever party's in power almost every time. When you look back through the data, that pure independent is going to break against the status quo almost every time because these people are non-ideological. They're not particularly passionate about either side. That's why they're independents, and they almost always hate the status quo, whatever it might be at the time.
So really, I mean, what you're talking about is in a state that is a key state, you're talking about 1% of the vote is up for grabs. And to the extent that it's up for grabs, it really isn't. It's almost predetermined on some level because it's just a function of what party's out of power.
Exactly. And what I'm arguing is that although you don't want to ignore that little group, I mean, you're going to give it some resource and attention, you sure as hell would not want to build your entire campaign strategy around it. And the turnout, we haven't gotten to this part yet, but the big innovation of my electoral theory is it's the elections are decided much more on turnout surge and decline. So when we look at who's been winning and losing in these giant swings that we've seen in Congress, those are not swings of enough fixed pool of voters who have turned against the Democrats because of Obamacare or turned against the Republicans because of Trump. It's a story of different voters entering and exiting the electorate, turned on or off by something that the literature and political science calls negative partisanship.
Okay. And this is one of the key dynamics between the two groups that we've just talked about appears to be that you can invest in one to the detriment of, to sort of like the negative investment in the other. Is that basically the story there? That if I invest in that 1%, say in Wisconsin, to try and win them, I risk alienating the other greater percentage of people that I may have access to who are motivated by negative partisanship.
Right. And it's going to be conditional on the electoral context. So in 2020, no matter how poor the Democratic strategy is, there will be a natural surge because people are terrified. And I talk about this in my forecasting work in 2018 and the 2020 version. The electorate is going to show up even if it's given a lump of coal to inspire it by, okay? But in a normal cycle, it could be disastrous, yes, if especially let's say we live in a post-Trump world, a Democratic president, that 2022 cycle in which Democrats run the same electoral strategies they ran in those 40 House races, where they avoided talking about national issues and they focused on this persuasion door knocking, and they didn't really do anything to stimulate turnout. The turnout came because it was naturally stimulated, but without a natural stimulator and no effort on the Democratic side to stimulate it, they would have a very rough 2022 cycle,
okay,
under my theory.
All right. Well, let's go back and then look at the 2018. So you've told us basically that your model is based upon this notion of negative partisanship, and that it really, for all intents and purposes, aside from that small percentage of pure swing voters, you're really dealing with definite Democratic partisans, definite Republican partisans, and then lean Democratic partisans and lean Republican partisans. And those two lean groups, as it were, it really is just a question of what's going to bring them out in any given cycle. Is that it?
It is, although there are many strong, in the voter files, if you don't have state partisan registration, you get a propensity score for voters. There are many strong Democrats, people who would have a strong Democratic score, who do not show up to vote. Okay? So it's not just these leaners that are needing the activation. There are many, many players the Democratic Party leaves on the side of the field due to their inferior campaign messaging and strategic efforts in campaigning. But yes, we're talking about on the margins, these independents who lean left, who are not going to come out to vote unless they either A, are naturally terrified as they are right now, or B, are given some kind of inspiration to show up. So think about Obama, the two Obama presidencies. When you look at what happened in them, in 2008 was a little different because, number one, we're coming out of Bush for 8 years, and there was a recession, right? A giant economic collapse, to be clear. And so Obama carried the vote of independents in that cycle. But in 2012, he actually lost independent voters, right? He didn't carry a majority of the independent vote, but he won the election. And the reason why is that his personal appeal was, and his campaign like strategy focused on turnout enough where turnout overwhelmed that independent loss, right? So it's very, very, very important to get those voters that are not committed to voting every election to show up.
So the other way I've heard people describe this, and you tell me if this is accurate, that we are, well, there's two theories, right, about how you run an election. One is persuasion and the other one is mobilization. And it to the extent that your that can be applied to your paradigm, your theory. It is that we are living in an era where it's more about mobilization than it is persuasion.
Yeah, well, number one, it's never either or, okay, because we don't live in a world of black and white. We live in a world of nuance, so it's never either or, and I always want to make that clear. But in the Democratic playbook now, there is a massive underinvestment in mobilizing and turning out Democratic voters, people who would cast ballots for Democrats if they could be gotten to the polls, Latinos, African Americans, millennials, people like that. And if Democrats simply focused more resources on turning out those voters, they would win elections in a lot of places they aren't winning now. I mean, Texas, for example, has had the demographics necessary to flip for a long time. The only thing missing is the massive investment they would need to spend in money in terms of Latino turnout. The same story in Florida. Why is Florida falling apart? It's because the party is not spending the money on mobilization of Latino, especially millennial Latino voters.
Okay, so when we look at 2018, who are the type of candidates? You know, you've expressed that if in a different political climate where there wasn't such, I guess, naturally, organically accruing negative partisanship. In other words, people hate Trump, or like, you know, those who are, you know, even lean Democratic hate Trump enough that they don't need the Democrats to come and say, get out and vote. They're motivated, highly motivated to vote. To the extent that there was a difference in terms of like candidacies across the board, to the extent that you're aware of them, like who did poorly or who didn't take enough advantage of that? Not, you don't have to tell me specific names. I mean, you can if there are, but I mean, how would you characterize the campaigns that should have done better than they did? Let's put it that way, and didn't because they pursued a certain tact.
Well, sure. I mean, a really great and handy example is the North Carolina 9 special election, and I tweet about this election quite a bit. I just put out a thread on it a couple of days ago. In North Carolina 9, they ran the conventional Democratic playbook there. They ran Dan McCready's advertisements and direct mailers, you know, hid basically the fact that he was a Democrat. Most of them were themed on his military service. And the goal or the idea was they were going to win that election by compelling some moderate Republicans to cross over. But the reality is, because we have these low turnout elections, even at the highest turnout, we have low turnout elections, even in a place like North Carolina 9 that has about a 6 or 7 point advantage for Republicans in that district, there was enough suburban and urban population for a turnout surge for Democrats to flip that district. All they needed to do was really focus on turning out the 2018 regular election voters again, right? And but they were worried about focusing on those voters would turn off these potential moderate Republican recruits that they thought they could get to flip over and vote for them. So that's, you know, they avoided anything that might excite Democrats in their pursuit of these, you know, mysterious Republicans that were going to defect. Meanwhile, on the other side, Republicans, they do nothing but mobilization strategy, basically. I mean, it's very little persuasion campaign technique coming out of the Republican Party. And the night before the election, they sent Donald Trump into the district to remind voters there, hey, there's an election. You don't know who Dan Bishop is. You don't care about Dan Bishop, but he's a friend of Trump. And by voting for him, you're helping Trump. That is good enough for the average voter, right? So instead of bringing in, you know, Michelle Obama to stump for the Democrat, or maybe Stacey Abrams or somebody like that to increase especially enthusiasm amongst those critical black voters in that district, the Democrats basically ran what I call the apologetic Democrat strategy, where they tried to pretend Dan McCready was not a Democrat. And the natural surge was almost enough still to overcome that, the turnout surge, but it would have been enough if they had tapped into that fright element and really, you know, went and tried to get Democrats excited to vote. But 80,000 people less voted in the 2019 special than in the 2018 general. And they lost in that 80,000 vote drop off. More Democrats dropped off than Republicans.
And so, and to be clear, in 2018, there was Republicans had a great turnout. It's just that Democrats had an even greater turnout.
Yes. And in fact, I have a voter file analysis that I have been talking about for months. So my long-term followers are probably like banging their head on the desk. But I promise waiting is going to be good. I got nerd famous and I had access to more data. So I've expanded the analysis. But what I show in that, number one is, yes, Democratic turnout in these 40 districts that flipped exploded. I mean, it was huge increases. And the turnout changed dramatically the composition of the districts so that they became, you know, younger, less white, more female, and thus more Democratic, okay? And so instead of being, you know, 38% Republican and 32% Democratic like they were in 2014, they became 38% Democratic and 36% Republican, and the independent turnout surged too, going up from like 20% to, you know, 25%. So the turnout surge flipped those districts. But here's the key point. In every single district that I've analyzed thus far, Republicans' turnout still exceeded Democratic turnout. There is not one district yet out of the districts that I've analyzed in which Democrats outperformed Republicans in terms of percent registered turnout. And in the districts where they ran blue dog Democrats, the turnout appreciably declined or lagged compared to regular Democrats. So like a blue dog paid basically a 10-point turnout penalty amongst partisan Democrats and gained absolutely nothing in terms of turnout for Republicans. The turnout for Republicans was the same.
No, wait a second. I'm confused. You said in the districts that they won, you still had more Republicans turnout than Democrats.
Yes.
But that means that some of those Republicans voted for Democrats.
No, because the margins that the Democratic candidates carried those districts by, my data will show this when it drops. It will show, like, you know, take example, California 25, okay? That's Katie Hill's district in Orange County. All right, that district had like a 30% turnout in 2014. It went to 60% in 2018. And it was, you know, more Republican, and then it went to more Democrat, you know.
Let me just clarify. You're saying that the increase in turnout, Republicans actually had a higher increase in turnout, but because there were more Democrats, the smaller increase in turnout actually meant more votes.
No, actually, what I'm trying to say is proportionally, Democrats had much larger increases because they had much more room to improve than Republicans did. When we talk about turnout declining, generally, Republican turnout is better than Democratic turnout, but because Democrats and independents turnout for both of those groups surged and broke for the Democratic candidates, that was able to overcome the fact that the turnout for Republicans was higher.
I see. So it was actually the independents, but we know that those independents, they're independent in terms of their registration, but they usually, if they're going to vote, they usually vote one way or the other.
This is the point about them. They are different independents than the ones that were showing up in the 2014 midterms and casting ballots for Republicans.
I see.
These are entirely different voters.
Yeah. I see. Okay. That makes sense. So you had in all of these seats, you had a greater turnout for Republicans than Democrats, but the independents made the difference. And this pool of independents, different independents are motivated in different political contexts. And that's the key there. You need to get those Democratic leaners to come out and vote in any given instance.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, and I don't have a way to show this quantitatively in the data, but the argument I make is, look, this turnout surge among independents and the turnout surge among Democrats, right? These independent surge, these have to be left-leaning Democrats. Because, and the definitely...
Left-leaning...
No,
okay,
left-leaning independents,
right.
Yeah. And there's no way that the surges are so large amongst independents and Democrats that the Republicans could have surged and had their votes go to these Democrats, because the margins that these Democrats carry the districts by, some of them are larger than others, but none of them are large, okay? They're pretty narrow margins. So they couldn't have been winning, you know, with big surges in Democratic and independent turnout and been taking over chunks of higher than normal chunks of crossover voting. It's just not mathematically possible.
So the story in these districts were that the Republicans were able to maximize their voters, but there just happened to be more people, both who identify as Democratic and independent, and those independents are sort of like a fixed group within themselves, that were motivated by essentially hatred for Trump.
Yes, and they would not tell you that, right? So if you ask Nancy Pelosi or Sherry Bustos, how did you guys win these 40 House seats? They will tell you they won by focusing on health care and cajoling moderate, disaffected Republicans to join hands with Democrats and flip these seats. And I am telling you that I have access to the voter files in five key states and the districts that are, you know, of these 40 in those states. And I have looked at, and I haven't looked at all of them, but I've looked at a pretty big chunk. And that is not the story that the data tells. The story that the data tells is completely opposite. It says those districts flipped because of turnout surges of Democrats and left-leaning independents. And furthermore, the blue dog Democrats, the handful that ran as, you know, blue dog Democrats, the turnout for Democratic partisans in those specific districts lag other Democratic turnout margins by about 10 points. So they not only didn't get Republicans to stay home, because that's the point, right, is to not rile up the other side and not get them to show up and vote against you. Not only did they not do that, but they also uninspired their own voters in a measurable, quantifiable way. And I'm hoping to put this analysis in a national newspaper.
Okay, and that's the dilemma. When you start fishing in the Republicans' pond, essentially, or you're not even fishing for votes as much as you are saying, like, hey, no reason for you to come out here because there's just no stakes for you. What you're also communicating is to your own people, there's no stakes and no reason for you to come out. And you need your own people, theoretically, your own, more than you need to depress the other ones, because the other ones you can't control to depress. Because now it's part of that also, like, how much of this, and maybe you can't tell this from your work, maybe this is outside your sort of your portfolio, but do Republicans and Democrats and, you know, Democratic leaners who identify as independents and Republican leaners who identify as independents, do they respond to the same type of stimulus?
So here's the thing. Democrats rely a lot on focus group material in which they have asked voters, you know, do you want this election campaign to be about Trump? And the voters, of course, say no. So if you ask voters, you know, is your vote about Trump or about bigger things, voters are going to tell you no. And, you know, it's really actually quite absurd. And I'm also a pollster. I do polling. So this is going to sound really funny coming from a person who does polling. But if you want to know how people behave, the last way to find out is to ask them how they behave, because people have no idea what drives their behavior, and no one's going to admit that they're driven by animalistic emotions, basically. Okay, so Republicans understand this, so they run all of their messaging is on negative emotions. Everything's really nationalized. So, you know, the ads that they ran in North Carolina 9 tied Dan McCready to the Squad, and it tied Dan McCready to Bernie Sanders. You know, like they brought Trump in to remind people, hey, you know, voting for this guy is a way to support Trump. Democrats we don't know how Democratic voters would respond in a competitive environment to stimulus like that because no one has tried it yet. The closest thing we have is Stacey Abrams and to a lesser extent, Beto 1.0 in Texas, but really Stacey Abrams. And she did like the back half of what I'm talking about in terms, because it's not just issue positions. It's about where you put the resources. What kind of doors are you going to knock? So, you know, why are 10 points, you know, Democratic turnout lagging 10 points in those blue dog districts? It's probably not just because they're, you know, taking these modest issue positions. It's also because they're GOTV focused heavily on these persuasion bucket doors,
right,
and didn't spend as much time knocking on high propensity Democratic doors, right? So that's the difference right there.
I want to go back to 2016 before we get to 2020. Donald Trump wins the election by winning Michigan by, what was it, 11,000 and Wisconsin by 22 and Pennsylvania by 40,000. You may know more specific numbers, but I think those are pretty close.
I do. I wrote a whole book on it. So.
Oh, well, there you go. All right. So what's the story there? I mean, what happened in the and there's I contend that there's about 12 different reasons why Hillary Clinton lost that election that may have been but fors. But in terms of the voters who showed up or didn't show up or motivated, like what the story that we're told is that it's the white working class in those sort of rust belty states there. That, according to you, is not true.
No, and I'm going to tell you what happened, and I want you to understand I'm not passing judgment upon you or anybody who's listening to the show, and I want them to listen to my whole spiel before they respond, okay? So I wrote a book on what happened, and I am looking specifically at the role of defection voting, or you might call it protest balloting, in the 2016 election. And the reason I focused on that is that the so-called Nader 2000 election in Florida, where, you know, Ralph Nader took a ton of heat because, oh, you know, people wrote in Nader and it cost Al Gore Florida and therefore we got George Bush, right? That election, Nader took about 1.5% of the Florida vote. In 2016, in Wisconsin, for example, 6.32% of the vote went to protest balloting. That's an astounding amount of vote for the polarized era to not go to one of the two-party nominees, okay? And in the book, and this is true from all three of the Midwestern states, it's true down in Florida, it's true all across the U.S., the modal or mean defection rate is in the 5% range. And so what I argue in my book is it is a product of the strategic choice made by the Clinton campaign, the campaign, not the candidate, and that choice was based on this outdated assumption of the electorate in which, you know, hey, the Republican Party has nominated a crazy baboon who is completely incompetent and shouldn't be within 400 feet of the White House. And so, therefore, we're going to nominate as our vice president this guy from Virginia who has this jovial reputation of bipartisan appeal, because it is our belief that we can get these moderate Republicans to come and vote for her if we don't offend them with our running mate pick and we make an appeal to them, okay? And thus we call this the persuasion pick, right? And that's the campaign's entire strategy. If you look at how they ran, and if you read my book, I walk you through specifically, you know, how the persuasion strategy manifests. People are like, why didn't Clinton talk about the issues? Clinton didn't talk about the issues because they were running a persuasion strategy from beginning to end in which they believed they could get a small chunk of Republicans, slightly bigger than normal in the polarized era chunk, to come over and vote for her because the other option was a crazy madman, you know, just absolutely unfit guy for office.
And so they were trying not to key people to think about the issues. And they were, you know, touting Tim Kaine, who is just Mr. All gosh, you know, all shucks. Okay. And that ended up being the critical mistake that they made, because what they should have done is picked somebody like Elizabeth Warren or Sherrod Brown or somebody with some populist appeal, because the Bernie-crats were upset. And being in power for 8 years, you tend to get a little bit more picky than when you've been out of power, right? And if she had just done that, if she had picked somebody that was appetizing to the people who had their hearts broken by the Sanders loss, then probably that defection rate on the left would have been cut at least in half. And she'd be sitting in the White House, even with, you know, the decline in African-American turnout or what have you. If she had picked a base mobilization VP pick, the entire strategy would have been different too, right? They would have been focused much more on the turnout end and the realities of the polarized era. So that's what I argue in the book. I put the blame not on the voter who cast protest ballots, and I want to make that clear. I put the blame on the campaign, who ran what I argue was the perfect execution of the wrong electoral strategy. I mean, this is not a time period in which the opposition party is going to come over and vote for you. I mean, case in point, in Alabama, 90% of self-identified Republicans voted to send a serial pedophile to the Senate because he had an R next to his name last year. You know, we are living in a time period in which persuasion of the other party is not going to happen. And you have to recognize the electoral realities that you're living in. And, you know, understand, too, that if you want people to show up for you in an election, you have to give them inspiration. You can't run as if you are embarrassed about your own party and ideology. And you can say what you want about Republicans and conservatism, but you will never see a Republican candidate on the stump who is embarrassed to be a Republican, right? I mean, that you just never see that on the stump. Yet the Democratic Party has adopted this kind of standard version of moderation, which is inherently flawed because it picks up from its very basic premise this idea that there's something inherently wrong with economic liberalism, right? And if your argument is, boy, there's something wrong with me, and your opponent's argument is the same thing, you're doomed from the moment that you leave the gate. So that's what happened in 2016. And of course, when I wrote the book, I didn't know that the Russian propaganda that was put out was specifically targeted on Facebook to people who were Bernie Sanders supporters, trying to get them to defect from Clinton. And I didn't know that they specifically targeted black voters to get them to not show up and vote. And of course, we also have all of the rosy polling that we had in those state-level polls in Wisconsin and Michigan. So I say in my forecast, Donald Trump's 2016 victory really is a perfect storm of things that had to all go a certain way for it to happen. And that's why I'm extremely doubtful that such a thing could happen twice.
And I guess maybe I don't know if it's even a conversation that, you know, based upon the work that you do, that you engage in. I have a theory about the search for that electorate and that persuasion was really a function of trying to fashion a victory of a specific coalition of people, because they wanted to, you know, this gets back to Chuck Schumer saying, you know, for every blue collar person we lose in Pittsburgh, we're going to get two in the Philly suburbs or something to that effect. And I think they wanted to do a whole infrastructure repatriation tax deal that Schumer was bragging about, and they wanted to protect Paul Ryan on some level and fashion their electorate. But that's maybe a different question for a different day. So let me ask you too. I have two other sort of like big things. I mean, I think your opinion about what, you know, Trump's chances in 2020 is what it is. I want to ask, you know, if there's how, A, how Democrats could lose that, B, what's happening in the Senate 2020. But let's start with impeachment. It seems to me from based upon what your theory is that impeachment would be very helpful for the Democrats because that will nationalize all of these races, which seems to be key. And impeachment in and of itself is inherently negative partisanship.
You're such a good student, Sam. I knew you would be. Yeah, so, I mean, definitely, right? And, I mean, of course, Democratic, I mean, if you follow me on Twitter, you know I am a deeply critical person about strategy on the Democratic side. And, you know, they boggled, bungled the first go at, you know, the Russia and Mueller report stuff. But here in this second go with the Ukraine scandal, it is so cut and dry. The you know, the president's conduct is just so egregious and the evidence is just so clear that even Democrats couldn't mess up this one. So they went with the impeachment inquiry and the politics. They thought, you know, at the time, gosh, this is unfortunate. We have to go and do our jobs now because we're worried this is going to be bad for us electorally. But the politics, little do they know, are actually great for them, as you just pointed out, is the best thing that could have happened to them. Because it will excite Democratic voters, and especially the part when we get to the airing of the evidence, and then the Senate Republicans say, yeah, too bad, we're going to just give him a free pass, because that is really going to anger a lot of people. And that anger is going to be, you know, absolutely, you know, a wonderful thing for Democrats electorally. And it's, you know, the Senate, they do need a big boost in the Senate. You know, I have Colorado. I haven't put in my rankings yet, and I'll put them out after the first of the year. But I've been pretty vocal that I think Colorado is definitely going to flip, and that Maine is pretty looking pretty good for Democrats as well. But we'll have a better sense about Iowa and North Carolina and Arizona based on what we see in terms of the turnout in these Democratic primaries, the Iowa caucus. If we see something similar to 2008 or ideally above, you know, if I was Joni Ernst, I would start to get pretty nervous. And I think we're going to see some behavior changes, too.
Well,
from
she's already nervous. She's already nervous, right? I mean, she came out. Come out and said, like, I think the call was inappropriate. Like, she's starting to sound like Susan Collins. On some level.
She is. And wait till December like 24th or something when the filing deadline for the primary passes. And you're going to hear a lot more nerves from Tillis and the crowd there.
Just to be clear, so people understand what you've just said. Once the Republicans get out of get into a safe harbor where they don't feel they can be primaried, or they know they can't be primaried because the filing papers aren't there, then they're going to tack hard to the center. But they're going to have
exactly
this.
Right.
But theoretically, I mean, if your theory holds true and it works both ways, that's not going to help them. That's going to hurt them with their base.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to help them, but they're going to do it anyway, right? Because what else can you do, right? You know, I mean, that's what I would expect them to do. But ultimately, at the end of the day, do I think that they're going to vote to convict Donald Trump despite the glaring, obvious, you know, excruciatingly bad details that are going to be laid out by that time? I can't get there. So I'm assuming what's going to happen is that they're going to have to rubber stamp this really atrocious behavior, and the reaction from the regular American voter is going to be, you know, people are not going to be pleased with that.
I will bet that Mitch McConnell will not make them take a vote. I know he said that they have to have a vote, but I think when it comes to the Senate, I think he's going to say, Congress didn't do, they're supposed to do a special dance when they send the bill over, and they didn't, and so therefore no vote. I mean, he's going to come up with some reason not to have a vote.
Oh, because, no, that's a pretty good guess, because, I mean, I just cannot see a scenario in which that is a winning moment for the GOP in the Senate, no.
Okay, so we still need to see what turnout is before you have a sense of whether the Democrats can or will take the Senate in 2020. What would it take for a Democrat to lose the presidential election in this environment?
Belief. I think it would take the party apparatus not believing in their nominee. Yeah, because, you know, when we think about, like, a lot of this research that, oh, you know, extremists don't do as well in elections. Well, number one, we don't get a lot of extremists that win the nomination in competitive environments. But we do see Kara Eastman last year in the 2018 cycle was one candidate who the DNC did not get to get their preferred pick in the primary. And so she went on into the general, and they did not support her robustly. And once the party doesn't support somebody, all of the tertiary organizations take that as a sign. And so your fundraising is really difficult. You know, Emily's List and all of the organizations that take their cues from the D-Trip. So her fundraising prospects were cut off a lot. And she still came within 1 point of flipping that Kansas district. If they had just spent the money and trusted they didn't know about my data, but if they had trusted my data and seen my data and spent the money and let the demographics speak for themselves rather than the nominee, they would have picked up that 41st seat there in Kansas, you know? So it's really important that the party believe in the nominee, I think. So, but that said, I say in my forecast that I think that, you know, it really doesn't much matter who the nominee is. To me, it's about risk mitigation. So there are different combinations and different tickets that make it, like, my model more confident and less confident. But I think all of them still produce. I mean, I would not stake my professional reputation on it. Otherwise, a Democratic win. I mean, Trump is just not going to be able to survive this massive turnout surge that's coming unless something happens that is, you know, completely unforeseen.
All right. I mean, I think more or less that is my sense, too. But what within the context of risk mitigation, who's the riskiest candidate from your perspective?
Well, you won't like this, I'm sure, but certainly Bernie Sanders would be the riskiest. And the reason is that, you know, the perception amongst the party that he is too, you know, the socialism thing is too, you know, too extreme to be digestible to a general election audience. That said, I mean, you have to think that they would rally behind him the way that, you know, Republicans rallied behind Trump in 2016. That said, and I'm here, you're going to like me even less. I've always been really sure that Bernie should not run in the 2020 cycle because I knew that he was going to perform, you know, below his 2016 cycle standards because of the two reasons. Number one, the in 2016 he was a big beneficiary from the smallness of the field. He basically got all of the progressive vote, but also all of the I'm not into Clinton vote, and a lot of that came from millennials. And this time around, obviously the field's much larger, so there's a lot more competition. But I had a feeling that Warren. See, like the progressives originally liked Warren and wanted her to run in 2016. And then when she didn't, they got into Sanders because Sanders basically ran as almost like a symbolic campaign at first, but then it ended up catching fire and being very impressive, right? But now I think that people are looking back at Warren, and I think she's just got a little dose of charisma that Sanders doesn't have. So I had said in the early spring that I expected at some point that Warren would and Sanders would inverse, and that has happened, and it's just, you know, it's looking like that's going to stay that way. And my expectation is we'll come into Iowa, and it will be Warren versus Biden, so the establishment frontrunner versus the progressive frontrunner. And some of it will depend on how stellar the Bernie base is in their support for Bernie, because he's just got this really, really committed, you know, 5 or 6% that I don't know would ever give up on. I mean, I think they would give up on him, but not in time to help Warren. And I think she might need that in order to overcome Biden, but But it will all come down to black voters. I mean, black voters stick with Biden, then he'll be the nominee. It will be the same way that it was decided in 2016. So that's what we're looking at.
Now, let me just ask you, I mean, obviously, I'm going to give you a little bit of pushback. I have to.
I would expect nothing less. I know enough about this show to know it's you know, I'm in friendly Bernie territory here.
Yes.
So.
Well, I mean, now I can, off the top of my head, name at least two races that just come to me immediately when you talk about not having the party apparatus. Ned Lamont against Joe Lieberman in his Senate race. I can't remember, mm-hmm. 10, 12 years ago. I know for a fact that the National Democratic Party said, we're not going to do the work for Lamont against Lieberman.
Right, right, right.
And Lieberman wins in his Connecticut for Lieberman party. And Martha Coakley in Massachusetts, when she ran against, Scott Brown, maybe the first time, or I think.
Yeah.
And
you're right.
She did not get the party apparatus behind her. And we saw the results in a race that should have been her. So, I mean, those are just two off the top of my head, just from my neighborhood practically.
Right.
But if the problem with not having the party apparatus behind you is resources in terms of money, resources in terms of organizing and mobilization, and a candidate like Sanders has shown an incredible ability to raise money, has a wide base of donor support in the context of the primary. And I think the theory of their campaign is we are creating an organizational structure that may be somewhat subterranean. Now, I think like Iowa is going to be sort of the test case for that, because it does not appear that, he's leading in the polls. I mean, it depends on which polls you look at, but I think probably the aggregate of polls, but that this organization that has been happening in terms of like outreach to unions and labor and whatnot is going to pay dividends. Where do you place those two factors into your calculus?
Yeah, so, you know, keeping in mind, too, like my calculus, like I don't have an emotional dog in the fight because I really don't, you know, I don't care, right? All I care about are the analytics and being right, of course. I like, you know, cannot be wrong. That's, you know, my main driver is being predictively right. So that's what's motivating me. And when I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, yes, so here's where Sanders had a massive advantage and where it's going to be hard, I think, for people who are deeply committed to him to kind of let this go is that, you know, for a long, we are super freaks in the information like bell curve. Like we, to us, like we've been watching this primary forever and we forget how atypical we are. So I always try to remind people, like, if you're listening to the Majority Report, you are not a normal human being.
Right.
You are not just a little bit more informed than the average American. You are 1,000% more informed, right? And so for a long time, Bernie's durability in the polls was name recognition. And the same story was true for Biden, right?
Yep.
And, for months and months and months, I was telling people, look, yes, they're both up there. I'm telling you what's going to happen in the polls once the rest of the world tunes in starting, you know, September, October, November, December. We're going to find out, is Biden actually a front runner or is that all name ID? But, you know, Twitter world, I've got bad news for you guys because I know you love Bernie. I know for sure Bernie's support is soft and it's going to inverse with Warren's, and this is why I know it, and I would lay out the reasons, right? And I do know intimately how deep his infrastructure support is. But here's the thing. That fundraising number that he posted this last time, yes, technically it was bigger than Warren's, and technically he had more donators, right? But keep in mind, too, this time for Warren, that is not including any transfers from her Senate campaign. This is the second quarter was that one, and this is the third. When we look at the next quarter, this is what's going to happen. Warren is going to out-fundraise him and be, you know, probably above him on individual donors because they were separated by about 60,000 individual donors. He had 1 million and she was at like 940,000. And they were separated by like, you know, I don't know, a couple $100,000 in terms of total money raised. And my guess is that, you know, the poll has inverted already. And the next thing that is going to invert is that fundraising total. Now, I could be wrong. I'm not often wrong, but sometimes I am. But my guess is this is the lowdown on the hoedown Majority Report listeners coming into Iowa, which is 4 months away from now. You are going to have to make a choice. You're going to have to either jump ship and support Elizabeth Warren, and really the progressive wing has the best chance that they've ever had to control the nomination for the party, or they're going to dig in their heels for too long, probably through Super Tuesday with Bernie, and that chance is going to slip away, right? Because that's what I was saying. I think Bernie's support is going to hold on for just a little too long, and it might be the difference maker between Warren being able to overtake Biden or not. But then you just never know, because it will come down to black voters. If black voters stick with Biden, and it will be a neck to neck like that. But if Warren is able to attract black voters, then she might just sew it up right out of South Carolina.
Well, I guess I was asking really more in terms of the general election. I mean, I was saying that your theory in the general election. I mean, I guess we will see what happens within the context of the primary. My understanding is that I thought that Warren's campaign had 940,000 donations, but only 500,000 donors. That is my understanding of that. And so, in fact, Bernie had almost twice the number of donors. And that
I don't know.
Yeah,
don't know.
I'm looking at a story right now. I'm looking at a story in the New York Times, and it says explicitly, Warren's campaign said on Friday it had received 943,000 donations in the third quarter from 509,000 donors.
Ah, there you go. Now, okay. So he's still doubling her on individual donors.
Right. And, you know, there's a lot of room, obviously, because something like 99.9% of them have not maxed out. But leaving aside the primary, because I think in the context of the primary, we're looking at a very different calculation than what we're talking about in the general, because negative partisanship doesn't necessarily go in play in the context of the primary.
Right.
But in the general election, what I'm asking is your theory about the Democratic apparatus. And I think it's quite possible that there's going to be people in the Democratic establishment who are like, I'm not helping Bernie. I mean, that seems possible. It also seems possible to me to some level with Warren, but much less so. And I've seen, you know, I've sat in a room, frankly, with some very big donors who were like, who, you know, I didn't know that Warren's wealth plan was every year. I mean, that they're that size donor.
Right.
But putting that aside, assuming that you're correct, that the apparatus would be hesitant to support Bernie. My question is, do you think the fact that Bernie has shown such an ability to raise money from those non-apparatus players that can overcome that in your calculus as to who presents the biggest risk in the general?
Yeah, so here's what I think, and I'm really glad that you asked that, because also, before I answer it too, we do have a very analogous situation on the other side, right? So just like you have this worry about whether the establishment would rally around Bernie, the establishment is worried about the progressives rallying around Biden, right? So
well, I think
kind
that's
of
even
the same.
I mean,
same.
Yes, and I think it's even worse, frankly, for Biden, because
yes,
I have
not met.
I've met people who are very, very, you know, excited about Pete Buttigieg, frankly, or
right,
Beto.
Right.
I have not met a single human being who is excited about Joe Biden. And
well, there are people out there, I promise you that. But yes, Biden's marketing is not excitement. He's the comfort candidate, right? He's a security blanket. People see him as the safety pick, right? So because they're told that all the time in the media, number one.
that he's the most digestible to moderates, that he's the one that Republicans would cross over and vote for in theory, right? So people see him as a safe pick, right? But yes, definitely on both sides of the equation, you have, if Bernie's the nominee, will the establishment folks rally around him? And if Biden's the nominee, will progressive folks rally around him? And here's my answer for both questions. Yes, because ultimately in this environment, which is completely different than 2016, people are not going to do anything that is going to risk Donald Trump winning the White House again. And it might take time, and you're going to see a lot. You're going to get a lot of phone calls, especially on a show like this. And you're going to hear individuals who are like, I'm not voting for Joe Biden, da-da-da-da-da, right? But ultimately, that 5.5 number I told you about, yep, for the defection rate, that puppy's going right back down. And it may be a little bit higher than it has been historically, because I think the Arizona Senate race is a great example of this. In 2018, 2% went to the Green Party candidate, even though the Green Party candidate tried to pull back and get out of the race and tell their voters not to waste, you know, their ballot on them, and that the Senate seat was critical, and to vote for Sinema, still 2% went to the Green Party. So I think about, if under a Biden situation, about 2% would still go to Tulsi Gabbard or Jill Stein or whoever is going to be the Green Party candidate. But it's not going to be 5.5%, that's for sure.
Rachel Bitkofer, the assistant director at the Wasson Center for Public Policy. Folks can follow you on Twitter. What's your Twitter handle?
So my Twitter is just at Rachel Bitkofer, B-I-T-E-C-O-F-E-R. You'll see it says the doc. And yeah, we have a good time on my Twitter. Lots of great intellectual discussion. It's a welcoming place for everybody, no matter what your ideology is. So yeah,
we will,
I suggest you come join us.
We will put a link to that in the podcast description and at majority.fm. I really enjoyed talking to you today. It was a lot of fun for me. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Sam. I've known about your work for a long time, long when I went back to get my PhD, and I was like, one day I'm going to talk to Sam Cedar on his podcast. So there you go.
There you go. Thanks, Rachel. All right. Bye-bye.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
There you go, folks.
I don't know if I want to believe some of what she said about Bernie.
Well, I mean, I think I think that in terms of the general election, it's something that we have talked about for a long time. I thought in 2016 that if Bernie had been the nominee, there would be more defections from the Democrats, away from him than it was from Clinton. But the question is, in that general election, like, how many people are motivated to come out and vote in that instance? You can't, who knows what the counterfactual is for 2016. And as far as the primary, I mean, I think there's a theory there. But I think, one of the things that we've been saying with the polls is, we don't know what this organization is. We don't know what the days or weeks ahead of us hold in terms of Sanders. I think, like I say, this week is going to be very important for Bernie Sanders. The debate and basically how he follows it over the next couple of days is going to be big for Sanders. And I do think there's a big difference. You have double the amount of donors. They have not maxed out. And the theory of negative partisanship, I think, really has been well tested. The other issues of within the primary, that's a totally different ballgame, and I think it remains to be seen. I happen to think that Biden is going to slip even more, because I mean, we have some factors that we just don't know about right at this point, which is what happens with impeachment. What happens? How much does this talk about Ukraine and saying Joe Biden's name over and over again in the context of this hurt him? What is Hunter Biden going out and doing an interview? This does not seem to me to be a campaign that knows what it's doing.
Go to Joe 303 3-0 and help me.
All right, Dad.
And, well, the Hunter Biden thing, I have to say, sounds a lot like my fictional character of Joe Lieberman's son in 2020. Just somebody who's going to, like, stink up the party. But look, we've gone way long here. Just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Your membership makes this show possible. Sign up for the AM Quickie, folks. Go to amquickie.com or look for it on your podcast server. Sign up. Gives you 5 minutes, headlines every day. Organize your day as you head out in the morning. Very quick and straight to the point. Occasionally make a little comment, or Lucy makes a little comment, but more often than not, just gives you the headlines very quickly. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And remember, when you shop, when you bank, when you browse online, your personal information is hanging out there. Thankfully, Norton 360 with LifeLock is an all-in-one membership for your cyber safety. Now, no one can prevent all cybercrime and identity theft, but Norton 360 with LifeLock is a powerful ally to help protect you and your information in today's connected world. Sign up today for a Norton 360 with LifeLock membership, and as our listener, you'll save 25% or more off your first year at norton.com/majority. That's norton.com/majority for 25% off. Today is Tuesday, but we're going to be doing debate night coverage live. Check out majority.fm or our Twitter feed or our Instagram feed for more information. But that means that you're going to be doing the show. What are you doing with my globe?
I'm taking the globe. It's like a talking stick.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Tomorrow night, we are going to be doing TMBS. Ryan Grimm is going to be in studio to talk about the debate, reactions, and, you know, the broader conversation around 2020. I just want to say real quick, I think that if Bernie performs well, and of course that's important, I think some of the sort of heartfeltness, in fact, that he's been speaking with in the last couple of days actually might end up being significantly to his benefit. So we're going to talk about that with Ryan Grimm. He's actually one of the original reporters on the Hunter Biden story. So we're going to have some fail son conversation and maybe even some square up to Jesse Waters conversation as well. In addition to that, updates on what's happening in Ecuador, where there was just a big victory, as well as Haiti, a whole bunch of other global stories. Patreon.com/TMBS. Oh, and at 6, we're going to do a pre-stream with McLean's journalist and friend of show, Andre Dumiz, who just did an interview with Jagmeet Singh, who is the Canadian Social Party leader. So we're going to have both of those things tomorrow night, the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. Snag your tickets to the Philly live show. And if you want to watch, I did an interview with Crystal Ball this morning on what's happening in Rojava. Both links on the Majority.fm homepage.
Jamie.
So first of all, I want to thank everybody who came out to the Goth Socialist Variety Hour this past weekend. It was a lot of fun, and it was really great to meet some of you. What are we doing this week? This show just like erased my mind. We were going to put up audio from the show, but that got messed up. We'll probably unlock something. But I think the episode that we put out last week is really good, and I'm really proud of it. And if you haven't listened to it yet, I encourage you to do so. Of course, we all support Bernie Sanders in the short term. I'm going to do everything I can to help him get elected. But in the long term, we at the Antifada are communists, and we believe that we need to go beyond social democracy in order to solve the problems facing us in this world. And this episode, we focus on the issue of immigration and borders in general. So Ross goes over why, how borders arose, the origins of the modern nation state, and the limits of economic nationalism and social democracy in one country, and makes a case for this inconvenient truth that sucks to think about. I don't like thinking about it either, but international communist revolution, in my opinion, is the only way to solve that shit. So I've gone on for far too long, but that's what it's about. And if you're interested, check it out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Matt?
Yeah, check out Literary Hangover. We're going to be talking about Arthur Miller's The Crucible coming up soon. And also check out Sam on Blocked Party, where
oh, yeah.
where you can hear him talk about playing GoldenEye and then get really quiet when they start talking about Perfect Dark.
Yeah, that things got a little awkward when they started dropping stuff that was like within the last, I don't know, 5 to 10 years.
Oh, Perfect Dark was a few months after GoldenEye.
I had a lot of fun at a block party, and I got harassed by a prank caller. God darn it. All right, quick break, fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.